Hello, welcome to another episode of What a Waste of Time. I'm Jim. I'm here with my good friend Callum.
Hello.
That's so convincing. Well done.
Hi.
Skipped a month because of illness and other commitments. But we're back. Yay.
Yay.
What we're going to talk about today is, I guess, remakes of films. Distinct from adaptations. Is remakes of films that were already films. I guess we can also do, like, remakes of TV shows that were already TV shows.
Well, there's also a thing now of making a TV show out of a thing that was a film, or vice versa.
Oh, yeah, like Fargo. Okay, so...
All that stuff.
We're going to go off topic anyway, so, yeah, there's no point defining it.
Yep.
Right, so I'm just going to set the timer for 1 hour. And let's go. Right, where shall we begin?
The culture of remakes are bad. Remakes are inherently evil. They were invented by Russia to make us sad. Like, is quite a prevalent narrative. By particularly, I think, critics that would describe themselves as cinephiles or people's mouthy dads, who I think are just the same person, actually, but one gets paid for it. So maybe we could start by saying a remake that we like before we go into dick on the whole thing.
Yeah, that's true. I really, really like the remake of Alfred Hitchcock's The Lady Vanishes. And I think that's better than the original. They make a few slight changes to it, and it's just a more entertaining version of it. It's also in colour, and you know we all know that colour is better than black and white.
Yep. Absolutely.
You're talking about, like, yeah, the culture of sort of like, oh, remakes are intrinsically bad. I sort of remember having an argument with a friend who shall remain nameless because I want to remain friends with him. But he got annoyed when he learned that David Fincher was going to be remaking The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because he said that all remakes of foreign films were racist. And I was like... and you know, I see where he's coming from a bit, like, you know, I do...
Swedes, notorious victims of persecution throughout history.
I can see his point a bit, where it's just like, you know, that we shouldn't... Like, if a film is good, we shouldn't need to just remake it, but with saying it in a different language, so that audiences will consume it. But then, of course, like, I don't necessarily see the problem of, like, remaking something for a different audience, because then you get to share a story with people who wouldn't otherwise see it. And so after he said that, I sort of made a point of going, like, I'm going to read the book, I'm going to watch the Swedish film, and then I'll watch the American film. So my opinion will be the most valid. And I couldn't finish the book because it was terrible. And the Swedish version was okay, but it didn't go into Mikael Blomkvist's motivation at all. I'm pretty sure that they didn't say, like, because in the book, the whole reason he goes to investigate this family is because Vanga says, oh, I'll give you dirt on Venestrum, and then that will clear your name. And I'm pretty sure that conversation never happens in the Swedish film, and it does in the American film.
Well, also, the Swedish one, and there are lots of people whose opinion I respect who really like the Swedish one, I think the only thing that's good in the Swedish one is Noomi Rapace, and Noomi Rapace is a big star now, so... I agree with that.
Yeah.
Good job, universe.
I will say I think the American version is the best version of that story. So I could say that maybe that's a remake that's good, but then I think the story is shit anyway, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that, like, when the American one came out, like, I agree, the David Fincher one is way better. For the big one is the Mikael Blomkvist thing.
Mm.
There's an effort to make him into an actual character through Daniel Craig. And however, it's funny because a lot of people were butthurt about them doing the American remake before it came out and anyone knew it was good. And my response was like, get over it, guys. Like, you know, like, it's going to be really good. And it sort of it's an easy narrative for me to keep supporting, because I think now the consensus is that it was good, but it, because of the ecosystem of movies at that time, it was hard to get David Fincher, Rooney Mara and Daniel Craig to keep coming back for them, so they just didn't. And now it's being not remade, but they're making a new one based on that fourth book that I don't know whether the original author wrote or didn't write. Who cares?
No, I'm pretty sure he wrote... he died after the third one, didn't he?
So. Right, and then someone got the go-ahead to write one more and then didn't write any others. And they're making a film of that, and it's done by the guy who did Peaky Blinders, and it's got now got Claire Foy, the queen of Tory feminism, instead of, literally the queen, instead of, I've no idea what Claire Foy's political views are, to be clear. I just think that the two roles she's most known for are The Crown and the wife in First Man.
Callum did not enjoy First Man.
I just think, I don't know, she feels like a go-getting girl that, like, a Sunday Times reader could get behind.
So I'm just aware that, like, this conversation started with us trying to name things that we like.
Yeah, I know. And it's already gone to me being someone's ranty dad. and I don't even have kids, so I win. And now that that movie's coming out, even though I quite like Peaky Blinders, and Claire Foy is a good actress, like, there's nothing... I can't even point to why it's going to be bad, but because it's not the version that I like, whenever the perfectly good trailer comes on, I'm like, she's too tall, or, like, whatever. So, hold on,
so you're sort of like... You were just criticising people for making their minds up about the original remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo before they had seen it, and now you're talking about doing the exact same thing.
Yep, so I'm basically saying we're all as bad as each other, because I'm doing the very same thing I got really annoyed with people about. I guess it's almost 10 years ago now, which is scary. We're practically dead. But I would also, I don't know, the only sort of slightly feeble defence that I have is that the trailer for the David Fincher remake is the tits. It was
with the whole Immigrant Song. Yeah, it was Karen O and Trent Reznor.
I mean, the movie was good. If it had been the movie that trailer promised, it would have been like, I would have been fucking untouchable, but it wasn't. Whereas this trailer is just, you're like, yep, that's a Girl with a Dragon Tattoo movie, and it looks better than the ITV, sorry, Swedish version. but, you know, it doesn't look like David Fincher's. So, yeah, I can be that guy too. But I also liked The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo Fincher remake.
I didn't like it.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was the best version of that story that exists. Because both the Swedish version and the American version quite rightly decide to skip the fucking long chapter at the beginning where he talks to this guy about business in a boat, and it turns out none of this is relevant to the main plot. But then still, the mystery is like, this girl went missing, and all the suspects live on this island, except for this one suspect who looks a lot like the girl who went missing, but she's in Australia, dismiss her.
Yeah, I haven't read the book. I think in the movie I was just like, oh, David Fincher doing fast cutting shots of filing cabinets being opened. I'm really into that. So yeah, I'm a stan of him as a director. So I was always going to like it. Oh, we were both going to say remake, though.
Yeah, it's your turn.
I guess this is two movies. I really like the Jump Street movies. I think, and sort of when we talked about this, one of the things we thought about touching on, but maybe was too narrow for a whole podcast, was the idea of remaking movies that were bad the first time. And I think that the Jump Street movies, have you seen them?
I've seen the first one.
Okay. So it's basically the idea of the Jump Street movies, I think, is genius, because it's basically saying, here's a sitcom. Was it even a sitcom or like a TV show that people only remember because Johnny Depp was in it, and that was one of his first roles, and that people make fun of the fact that they did not look like, you know, two cops had to go undercover in high school. They did not look like high schoolers at all. but no one does who plays high schoolers on TV, especially during the 80s or whenever it was that it came out. That's quite funny, ha ha ha. And then because of Hollywood's, you know, sort of strange aliens in Starship Troopers-esque desire for IP, and they just want to consume all the IP, and there will never be enough IP. They wanted to remake the Jump Street films. So they wanted to remake Jump Street as a movie, and they wanted to make it a comedy. And it's just brilliant. Like, it's so much better than the TV show ever was. And it's sort of, it's like, it makes the fact that they don't look like high schoolers into a joke. It's a really, really good action comedy. It's so well cast. Like, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill clearly play really well off each other. They have genuine, sort of chemistry that works really, really well. They sort of do the idea. It's also just got a great, like, even the sort of smaller parts, they happen to get good people at times when they would do that movie. Like, Brie Larson's in it, Dave Franco, the best Franco, is in it. I guess he's the rock to James Franco's Hard Place, but, you know, he is the best one. I just think it's a great film. The sequel is not an incredible disappointment. I don't think it's as good as the first one, but any movie that has a scene in the... Oh, there's just a scene where Ice Cube... His daughter's done something he doesn't like, and he gets angry at a buffet. And it's just... I can't just watch it. It's the best thing ever. I really, really like it. And I think it supports the idea that Hollywood should be taking stuff that's a bit crap.
Mm.
And remaking that, because you're not going to disappoint anyone. Like, no one's going to look at the Jump Street movie and go, oh, it doesn't measure up to the original, does it?
Yeah.
They were just going to be like, well, this is either a bit disappointing like the first one, but we'll go because of the brand recognition.
Yeah.
Or this is actually really good, and it's going to get word of mouth because it will surprise everybody being really good.
Yeah. But then, I mean, that's a sort of difficult area there, because, like, I mean, we all know that the reason that Hollywood does so many remakes these days is because of the brand recognition, you already have a built-in audience, so it makes money regardless of the quality of the film. This sort of conversation sort of sparked out of this idea of, like, you know, the Hollywood or remakes or these things that already sort of perhaps shouldn't be touched because they're fine as they are. And so wouldn't it be interesting if Hollywood instead took... films or ideas that hadn't done so well the first time but were a good idea, but then of course if it hadn't done so well the first time, you don't have that brand recognition.
Well, I also think what was interesting was because then Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who did those movies, kind of made a career out of this, where, I mean, they made Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is weird but great, and then they got that gig, and it turned out that they were really good at taking and identifying what was good about an idea, exactly as you said, and then going with it. And also that the studio is clearly willing to give them more room than if they'd been allowed to adapt something with more prestige.
Mm.
And so they did a great job of that. They sort of did their own thing with it. It was then a big success. There was a sequel. They also did the Lego movie, which, again, when it was announced, people were just like, oh, this is going to be awful. It's like so shamelessly just an advert for a toy that I'm going to have to sit through with my infant for 2 hours. And it turned out to be like one of the best animated... And it came at the right time because Pixar was sort of declining and it was filling that gap. And again, because they were kind of allowed to do what they want and make jokes about the fact that this is just an advert for a toy. Not that's what made it good. It was a great story and really well done. And so again, they do that. And then it's interesting that the first time they really fell flat on their faces was doing a Star Wars film, which was a prestige property. And the exact problem they came up with was people going to them, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
When their job had been given, like, here's this garbage fire.
Fix it.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas they were given, well, what's interesting is actually a Han Solo movie is a garbage fire. But the people did not know they'd made a garbage fire. They thought they'd made, like, a beautiful meal. And so, you have Phil Lord and Chris Miller going, no, it's on fire. And the studio going, no, people like that.
Mm.
Like, keep it on fire. So, yeah, I just wish it was, because I'm smarter than all Hollywood executives. All of them. but please hire me. I think that none of them quite recognised that as what Phil Lord and Chris Miller are good at.
Yeah.
And that there's a thing they could do more of here.
Yeah, well, I also think in the case of Solo, like yes, you know, Phil Lord and Chris, they have a sort of, they're more used to more freedom than maybe the people behind Star Wars would give them.
Specifically John Kasdan.
Yeah. Although I feel they gave Rian Johnson tons of freedom because he just went crazy. And some people liked that and some people did not.
Oh, have people talked about that on the internet yet?
I've heard some rumblings. So I do sort of feel like what the studio wanted was this Solo film that was... I'm sorry, it's just... crying children going past the window, if you can hear that.
Interrupting us, saying why children's film is good. Bloody children.
It's a family film! That's the thing, yeah, it's they wanted, I think, a sort of action film with comedy elements, whereas and if that's what you want, I mean, I suppose that I can see, like, from Jump Street, you might think that, oh, yeah, that's Chris Lord and Phil Miller, have I got that right?
Phil Lord, Chris Miller.
I knew it's like, that doesn't sound quite right. Phil Lord and Chris Miller, that's what you hire them to do. But I don't think that's really what they wanted. They didn't want a comedy. They wanted this more of an action film with comic elements.
Yeah, it's just another classic thing of them not being able to identify. Like, because, yeah, you're right. I'm sure that they, like, watched... someone, like, they all watched a bit of Jump Street on YouTube and were like, oh, action comedy, great.
Mm.
Whereas it's like, no, like, Jump Street's a movie where Channing Tatum, like, Jonah Hill grabs Channing Tatum's balls because he thinks they're a hand grenade and tries to pull them out and throw them at someone in a helicopter. Like, don't hire those people. Like, and it's a great joke about balls and hand grenades. Like, I'm not... I promise it's very funny in the context. But, like, don't hire those people and then be like, oh, they tried to make jokes and then be cross about it. What they wanted was Guardians of the Galaxy. But it's like, you already had James Gunn. You're just going to do that too.
Yeah, James Gunn would have done a better Solo film than Chris Lord and...
Well, I think I'd have liked to have seen Phil Lord and Chris Miller's Solo film. I think it just would have been... what people were accusing it of being, which was Ace Ventura, Millennium Falcon detective, which would be a fascinating artifact. I don't know whether it would be good, whereas I think the version of Solo that everyone else involved was trying to make, James Gunn would have done a better job of.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Nick, if you're listening to this, I know that you're screaming about James Gunn because you have opinions about him, but you're not here, so shut up.
Yeah.
James
Gunn is my best friend.
Since we've arrived to Star Wars, and we have already touched on the notion of like remaking bad films which had good ideas, the one that people, including me, discuss a lot is potentially remaking the prequels. Because I don't know if you know this, dear listener, but the prequels were not well received. They made a shit ton of money, but people did not like them. So which is why I'm still astonished that, like, even if you didn't like The Last Jedi, people didn't like The Last Jedi, but they're saying, oh, give it back to George Lucas. And I'm like, no! He didn't make good Star Wars films either. Give it to someone. Like, fine if you don't like Rian Johnson, but the answer is not George Lucas.
Also, the biggest barrier to George Lucas not directing his films is that he doesn't bloody want to.
Yes.
Like, it's just... even he knows he's a bad director. Like, have you seen the story where David Lynch tells, like, how he got... It's quite short, so I can summarise it very quickly. Have you... like, what happened when George Lucas tried to get David Lynch to direct Return of the Jedi?
I think you have told me, but let's hear it again.
Basically, normally when film people say, like, I haven't even seen Star Wars, I don't even know what Star Wars is, I'm just like, oh, fuck off. Like, you know, it's just... there goes the language rating for this podcast. You know, be a human. It's on the side of buses. We all know what it is.
Mm.
When David Lynch says he doesn't know what Star Wars is, I sort of believe him. Like, especially in, like, you know, the 70s or whenever this would have, or the 80s, whenever this would have been. Essentially, they asked David Lynch, like, is it true that you got asked to direct Return of the Jedi? And for once, he's not invasive in his answer. And he sort of goes, yeah, I was. And it was very weird. He says, here's the thing. George doesn't like directing. People don't say this, but he just doesn't like it. He told me he doesn't like directing. And I had to go and... he flew me up to San Francisco, and I had to took me in his car, and it's very weird because he bought a Ferrari, but he's very short. And then he took me to look at a thing called a Wookiee for the movie. And it's really funny because you can see at this point every Star Wars fan in the audience salivating. Because I think this is one of the first times that they basically put together the thing that, like, it was going to be Wookiees, but they made it into Ewoks in the movie. And David Lynch is sort of confirming that he saw this, and the Star Wars fans were all like, "Ooh!" And David Lynch had no idea of the significance of, like, what he's just dropped. And then he said, "Yeah, but I had this terrible migraine. And I just said to my agent, I can't do it. I don't want to do it." And he said, "That's okay, David. You can go home." And so I said to George, because I had this headache, I said, "You should do it." And then he did. And so, and it's just like, yeah, I mean, like, the key information there being that, like, George Lucas dislikes directing films, has sort of never wanted to direct the Star Wars films, but also, like, because he created the universe, people keep telling him that he should do it. And so it, until he just sold it, and then Disney were like, okay, we're Disney. We are not like, because all the people he'd gone to before to direct it were other directors who have a different perspective on this. And they'd gone like, no, this is your world, George, you must do it. And they also, he went to every single one of those directors at a time when he was just a guy directing three massively successful films that changed the face of cinema. So I guess their attitude was like, well, he can't be that bad.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's just being an artist.
He's just changed the face of cinema.
Right, you know.
That's not a phrase you bandy around lightly.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, how bad could it be? And then the prequels came out and they went, oh, it's that bad. So yeah, it's just that, it's so weird that, like, people still want to give the movies back to George Lucas when Disney, yeah, literally anyone in the world would do Star
Also,
Wars.
Like, quite aside from your opinion of George Lucas, like, let him retire. That's what he gave it to Disney because he wants to retire, and he's done enough work as a human being. He's allowed to do that.
He also is just, what George Lucas is good at is being a producer. If there's one thing I want George Lucas to do more of, apart from, but yeah, you're right, he should retire, is produce more films, because he's obviously very good at that. Like, there's a great BBC documentary, which is, it's sort of like dewy-eyed propaganda for the BBC and the British film industry about, like, the strength of our film studios and whatever. But it basically covers, like, the relationship between Star Wars and the sort of major studios in the UK, like Elstree, Shepperton, Pinewood and all those places. And they talk about how those studios were, Star Wars kind of made them into what, well, they made them into the international thing that they were, as opposed to before where they were just a thing where they did mostly British films. And his, you know, it was like, the idea to shoot in the UK was like, it's, no one did it. Like, you know, the very idea of shooting abroad to save money was brilliant. You look at the process you went through in hiring people who were, you know, especially the design department, that were people who were really sort of down and out, but he was able to identify what those people would bring to the world. The fact that he decided to give up a big cut of his fee for the movie for the merchandising rights to the toys, when the idea of merchandising for movies then was just laughable, like making action figures of a film, like no one will do that. So he clearly has, like, and also Star Wars as a concept is great. He even knows himself that other people should have been directing it, and he tried to make that happen many, many times. If you look at the list of directors he approached, they all could have made a great Star Wars movie, even David Lynch if he didn't have a headache, I suppose. And so, you know, I mean, like, he did direct Dune at the end, well, which I guess is bad, but it's, you know, it would have, you could have got him to do it. And then that's what George Lucas is good at.
Yeah.
The idea,
because, yeah, if you look at the prequels, there are tons of really good ideas in there. I really like the idea that, well, we have Senator Palpatine, who is being the sort of puppet master, and you sort of realise, like, without it really being explained to you, like, oh, he's on both sides of this war, and it doesn't matter who wins, Palpatine wins, and that's how the Empire comes into control. Like, and that is a genius idea.
But it also leads to the one good line in all the prequels, which is, like, this is how democracy falls, with rapturous applause.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah. Yeah, no, that's stuff.
What are you talking about? There's tons of good lines in those prequels. Like, how did this happen, Anakin? We're smarter than this. Like, yes you are, Obi-Wan. Yes you are.
Because we said we are. Oh my god.
One of my personal favourites. No, 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 you will die! It's gold. It's gold. Will. It's gold right there, Callum. I don't know what you're saying. This is a flawlessly written film.
Oh, Yeah, they're just terrible.
But yeah, anyway, like to come back to remakes a bit, like we did want to talk and about like. Let's not necessarily how we would remake those films, because everyone's got a take on that. I don't think they're hard films to fix, in air quotes. Which is, but like, I think that maybe what we want to discuss more is like whether you should.
Yeah, because on the one hand, and it's something that I've definitely done a lot of. It's a really fun conversation to have of how you would remake the Star Wars prequels. It's like or remake any, you know. Remake any sort of movie that's bad, especially. I mean, I guess you can do it with sort of independent-y films as well, but especially something that's adapted that has an established like fan base and lore and whatever, because you can sort of, we're all kind of familiar with the moving parts of that, and it's fun to think about what those things would be, and also helpful. And I do think, especially with the Star Wars prequels, the conversation around how one would remake it has led to some sort of great stuff, especially in the sort of YouTube film criticism culture, which I think is really good because it democratizes the whole idea of film criticism. But on the other hand, I sort of hit a barrier with this when it came to the conversation which I had with some friends and also on the internet around Rogue One, which I think I liked more than the average person, but I also was aware that there are big flaws in the film. And I think that one of the things that was a bit difficult for me was that people would say, you know, like, Rogue One should be a straight-up heist movie, but it sort of is two things. Or Rogue One should have been a movie about the rebellion, and it should have been about those battles, but instead it's a mess of things. And I think people, I'm like, well, you could do that, but it wouldn't be what Rogue One was trying to do. And isn't it a more interesting conversation to have is what Gareth Edwards was trying to do with Rogue One, and was or wasn't that a good idea? And this is sort of a specific thing, but I think it speaks to the wider element of the movie. The thing that's most fascinating to me about Rogue One is the market scenes where she first meets Donnie Yen's blind character. Those scenes were all shot. What Gareth Edwards did was Star Wars, understandably, because it's a very polished blockbuster, shot in a very kind of 70s blockbuster tradition. It's all like very kind of like locked off frames or like, you know, distinctly planned tracking shots.
Yeah, well, they sort of, a lot of them have to be locked off frames in the originals because they're shooting through matte paintings, well, which is the only way of doing that.
Yeah, and also like there's literally like what you can see is the whole set, you know, and that's it. Whereas Gareth Edwards, and again, because he was directing a Star Wars film and they had the money for this, was he actually had them build this whole market, 360 degrees, had all the actors just running the scenes, and he operated himself and then would basically improvise the shots and sort of run the scene lots of different ways. And I think that's fascinating to bring that to Star Wars. And if you watch those scenes with that in mind, you sort of start to see the really interesting movie that was coming out underneath. And then sort of there's that part, and then there's also the second part of the movie, which is sort of widely known now, is basically Tony Gilroy's film, which is the more polished, slick, like, great finishing battle, the stuff with Darth Vader, which is also interesting because Tony Gilroy is outspokenly not a fan of Star Wars, doesn't like it, but does like making films a lot, and so he didn't want to turn down that job. And again, it's like what you're then seeing is a Star Wars movie made by the guy who made Michael Clayton, which is like one of the best films ever about, you know, like power and institutions and how to fight them, and like a kind of polished filmmaking, but of a very different kind that Star Wars normally is. And both of those things, not sort of lean too hard into the auteur thing, like it's not just that that makes film interesting, but those are both two really interesting films that Rogue One could have been. And I just feel like going like, well, the film was bad, so let's wipe that off the table completely. And I think the film should have been this whole new thing. It's like, well, there were interesting things happening. And I don't think that the problem with the movie is that like the studio came in with their jackboots and stamped on Gareth Edwards. And then it's like, no, like maybe Tony Gilroy's idea didn't 100% work. And maybe Gareth Edwards' idea didn't 100% work. But there was something interesting there, and maybe it's more interesting to talk about. I don't mean literally now, but I mean like in general when we talk about films, maybe we should think more about, well, what was the filmmaker trying to do, and why did or didn't it fail, as opposed to what do I think the movie could have been if that's completely different.
Yeah, because it's like it's not necessarily difficult to sort of take something bad and make it good. what is harder is to identify, like, what was this supposed to be, and why didn't it achieve that, and is it even possible for that to... It's sort of a kind of a patronising thing to say to, like, oh, let's fix this film. It's like, well, you know, no film is perfect anyway. It's sort of a kind of patronising attitude to say, oh, this film is broken and needs repairing. It's just like, no, they tried a thing and it didn't work. And, you know, and I think we should really be okay with that. Like, I remember, like, the amount of pressure people put on Last Jedi to be good, and they have various opinions about whether or not it achieved that. But I sort of, like... I just felt like we should be okay with the idea of Disney making a bad film. Because if all of them, like, what's worse is if they're all fine. And Disney's just doing something safe. And stuff that they know the fans will like. And just sort of repeating the beats of the past. And nobody wants that, really. What's more interesting is taking risks. And sometimes risks don't pay off. And That's just part of the hazard of taking a risk. And so, yeah, I sort of feel like if Disney makes a bad film, like, that should be fine, because at least they've taken the risk. At least they're going about it in a interesting way.
Well, also, it's... if we are going to be in, you know, a place where a million films about the same thing, be it, like, Marvel or Star Wars or whatever, are being made... The whole benefit of that is it gives people with massive budgets room to fail. Like, that's the way it should be. I mean, if you look at the last time... If anyone listening to this is like, actually... But, like, you might be right. My understanding is the last time that really happened was sort of Westerns with the Golden Age of Hollywood. Mm. And, like, yeah, like, now we look at that and we just think, oh, well, it was just a parade of brilliant, innovative films. You know, late Westerns. It was like, you know, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and The Searchers. And those are the two that I know, but like, here are the lots of others. I know Stagecoach, but that wasn't a late one. And it's, but like, yeah, we remember Stagecoach, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But like, if someone was like, hey, Callum, I've got all of the late Westerns. Do you want to sit down and watch them all? I would... rather like shove pins in my eyes. Like, I just can't think of anything worse. I'm sure so many of them are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, people, like, Hollywood was just saying, there's fucking someone in a cowboy hat, people are gonna come, so that's all we care about. You make your like weird movie and that's fine. And we're at that stage with superhero movies.
Yeah,
that's why you get, and it's funny that if you, I like lots and lots of the Marvel movies, and I think overall they're doing a good thing. I think there's lots about Infinity War that's incredibly... I think almost Infinity War is their weirdest one, which is quite strange, because it was the biggest one. But the like, if you look at sort of the ratio of, not even good or bad, but quote-unquote interesting films in the Disney-Marvel films versus the X-Men films, it's interesting that, like... a lot of the sort of X-Men stuff is bad.
Mm.
And then people sort of throw their arms up and go, oh, well, they're failing. And it's like, well, they are quite a lot, but when they don't fail, it's like Deadpool 1 or Logan.
Yeah.
And those are great. And they're like nothing we've ever seen before. As opposed to, you know, Marvel, where, like, you know, the worst film they've made might be Ant-Man 1 or Doctor Strange. Sorry, Nick. It's just, you know, it's the ones that are distinctly vanilla. That's the worst thing about... Well, even Thor 2 isn't that really bad. It is just forgettable.
Mm.
And you just think, like, you know, what if they... I think they'd have made so many more Guardians of the Galaxy than Black Panthers if they'd really been... like, we can just push people, like, we will let people do what they want with that.
Mm.
But then again, I don't know. It's just, yeah, I think the idea, the whole, the narrative of, like, especially, well, it's like, with big movies is, if this movie hasn't, like, it's it Solo, people think it's a financial failure. It's like, no, it just didn't make as much as Force Awakens.
Yeah, it didn't break box office records, which in Star Wars terms is a failure, but in film terms, oh my fucking God, it's not.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it means loads of people liked it, and it made back its budget just fine. Like, you know, it's all... and so, they are now all Star Wars spin-off stories are on hold in movies, are on hold at Disney now.
Yeah.
Because of, just because of press. Not because of box office, but because of press.
I see so many sort of like hot takes on YouTube. Well, I don't watch these videos, I just see the thumbnails and the headlines. Of just saying that Star Wars is in trouble and like, oh, Kathleen Kennedy is the Antichrist and look, and it's like, no, Star Wars is doing just fine. It's like they've made one controversial film, and that's the thing that bothers me about people say, oh, Last Jedi is objectively bad. It's like, no, it split people. It was a critical darling. If you didn't like it, fine. But you can't say it was terrible and they've lost the plot entirely because they made a shit ton of money and people and critics liked it, which is all a film needs to do.
And
Solo, so it was kind of dull and forgettable. It wasn't bad. It didn't make tons of money. It did make tons of money. It didn't make as much money as they hoped for, and that's why they're sort of reevaluating their strategy on this. But there's going to be another Star Wars. There's going to be tons more Star Wars films. They're all going to make tons more money.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, if it's with film with mainstream blockbuster movies, it's that, you know, it's that narrative of if it doesn't break box office records, what was the fucking point? And if it's more on the sort of independent side, it's, did this win prizes? You know, be it at, you know, major film festivals. You know, basically, did it win Cannes, Venice, Sundance, Toronto, somewhere like that? Or did it win Oscars? And if it, you know, or did it get a consolation Golden Globe? And if it didn't win that, then what was the point of it? And it's just like, no, there's so much more room for other movies like that. Mm. And also, these movies exist. Like, there are filmmakers like Jeremy Saligny with movies like Green Room or Mandy or, like, other films that are sort of, you know, like, chugging away in this sort of, you know, there is a mid-budget movie market still that makes movies that aren't sort of these target for awards and press and that narrative. And it's just, it's a shame that it's sort of like, oh, this movie failed. And it's like, well, no, it just, you know, it becomes something with like a, you know, a cult following, or it's like, there are so many ways to succeed. There are so many ways to contribute.
As I was doing, like, I was actually doing prep for this podcast and we've gone massively off topic, so that was wasted. I was sort of looking, like, cause you know, we had been talking about like, looking like remaking bad films and putting another take on it. So I looked up a list of films that were bad but had great ideas, and Donnie Darko was on the list. I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Right.
Yeah. Donnie Darko's a cult phenomenon. Like, just, okay, you didn't like it, and maybe it didn't smash box office records, but it's like, that doesn't make it bad. I think it did what it set out to do. By that metric, it succeeded. That was such a weird thing to say. It's like, oh yeah, Donnie Darko, terrible film. It's like, what are you talking about?
Right, or like, the whole press narrative with Venom was just bizarre. Because Venom was, like, not quite like a normal superhero film and had some flaws. But apart from that, it was basically fine. Like, and I don't think they're just my friends trying to pacify my ranting. Maybe they are, I don't know. The people that I've spoken to who've been to see Venom have all just gone like, yeah, it's fine. Like, it's not amazing. But because, again, it didn't break box office records, like, critics have been like, oh, God, clicks. How can we spin this narrative? And they start saying, because Tom Hardy's performance is admittedly weird in it, but not so weird that you should go and see it just for that. There is a great bit where he walks into a restaurant, pulls food off someone's plate, takes one bite and yells, this is dead, and then throws it at them. And so there's a lot of that kind of thing. But that's not worth seeing the movie for alone. It's just like a pretty solid action movie. Like, I don't know. But again, because it wasn't like stupendously successful, there are lots and lots of articles of saying, like, is Venom so bad it's good? Like, is Venom the Room of superhero movies?
No.
Yeah, it's just, it's so dumb. Like, why does it have to be either? Like, it's, and also what's interesting is there's the idea, I do think we have a problem with our perception of what innovation and quote-unquote greatness, such a nebulous concept, looks like, where we think, and this does bring me back to First Man, where we think that what greatness is doing what past great people have done but more. And if we do what past great people have done, but more. And because of the hindsight narrative we have of them, we just look at the successes. We think, well, by succeeding, you succeed more and harder. And then at the end of your life, there is a parade. and they put a black and white photo of you up at whatever the industry award for your chosen profession is. And then you've gotten all the points. And you just look at people who actually, like, but then actually you look at everyone through history in any field. Most of them were massively controversial at the time they were around. People really didn't like lots of what they did. They normally did, like, some things that people did like that meant they kept working or operating. Some of them even didn't do that. But you look at that, and often they just failed a lot, and they really pissed people off, because that's how it actually works. But we don't sort of, we don't look at this overwhelming evidence for this pattern and go, maybe we should be looking for the things that are different from what we know now. Yeah. And instead we just go, no, give us the same, but more.
Yeah. We also don't remember failures. Looking back, we look back at the golden age of Westerns now, and we remember all the good films. We don't remember all the dreck that was pushed out just because that was what was popular. I see people that talk about, they don't make things like they used to. It's like, no, they do. It's just you don't remember all the shit.
Yeah.
Because why would we remember that? And I suppose that's kind of a gratifying thing. It's like you might as well try do the mad off the wall risk taking thing that you want to do, because people probably won't remember it if it's bad.
Yeah, it is one of the things that sort of grates me about. Like, it was the core thing that grates me about, Damien Chazelle and Whiplash, La La Land, and First Man. And you can sort of see why he chose, because First Man, new Oscar bait movie about who's the fucking Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon, that's his name, who seems like a great guy. He made a really valuable contribution to history, but my friend Mike, who knows much more about astronauts than I do, said, you know, if you go and ask Neil Armstrong, Neil, how did you become the first man on the moon, his answer will be a polite version of, I went to work every day and I didn't fuck up. Like, everything that Neil Armstrong did that is shown in the film First Man is just like, you know, he does amazing things with aircraft and spacecraft at the very last minute and while making insane calculations, and also, but it's like, all astronauts can do that.
Yeah.
Like, you could pick any anonymous astronaut from history and they could do that. And so Neil Armstrong was just lucky enough not to die, because lots of them get killed by outside factors, because what they do is incredibly dangerous.
That's the thing,
which is why the
survivors are the lucky ones. It's
right.
Like, you go to an old person's home and they'll all have some story about some like scrape that they very narrowly avoided in the war or something, and you're like, wow, all of these people here are so lucky.
Yeah, because then you've got the death toll in World War II. And it's like, oh, I guess that's how many were unlucky.
Yeah.
Right, and so And that's why he's commendable as a person, and we should be grateful to him as we should be for the ones that didn't make it. But as a film, it's just a man trying really, really hard and then succeeding.
Mm.
And then you look at La La Land is just two actors being like, how do we become great actors? Well, one wants to be a musician, one wants to be an actor. We try really, really, really hard and then we do it.
Mm.
And then Whiplash is an entire film of a teacher in a school that's supposed to be Juilliard. They call it Booliard or something, but it's Juilliard. and then the teacher of Booliard's teaching Miles Teller the bums instead of the drums. And he says, like, he keeps saying to him, like, you know, these jazz musicians like Sonny Rollins and whatever, like, they were getting up every morning and they were drumming till their hands bleed. So now we have a scene where Miles Teller's hands bleed. And it's like, well, they did do that, but they also, like, really annoyed teachers like you. Because at the time, they were not doing what those teachers told them. Coming from me, someone who was far too much of a coward to go against those teachers when they've been in my life. You know, that teacher would have hated the musicians that he likes when he's naming them in the film. And the film doesn't acknowledge that at all. Mm. The narrative the film builds is, all those musicians just did jazz the hardest and the best, and now they're the best musicians. And the reason I'm talking about these movies is because those movies all won lots and lots of awards. And Damien Chazelle is beloved by the critical establishment and is beloved by the Oscars because that's a narrative of greatness that our media likes. It's the narrative of you do what everyone else did, but more. And failure is shame. And failure is pain. And it just sucks. Like, yeah.
We do need more stories about failure because, like, failure is... It can be just as important a piece of someone's journey to success as trying really hard. I think we also have to acknowledge that some people achieve success without trying at all.
There's a movie called... it's called Not Fade Away, which is a feature film that David Chase, who did The Sopranos, made. When you make The Sopranos, you're just like, I want money for a feature film, do whatever the fuck I want. Someone will be like, yeah, okay. And it's about a band that doesn't make it. And I saw it, and I was just, and I sort of, about halfway through, I was like, this is sort of the point where they get famous, isn't it? And then they never do. And I was just like, well, and I thought, why is that bothering me? And I'm like, no reason other than that's what always happens. And you just realise, like, the movie about people trying to make art is no less entertaining, whether they become famous or whether they don't. Because actually, the things that happen to you, if it was the first movie you'd ever seen about a famous person, I guess it would be interesting, but there are lots of movies about famous people. So, you know, it's just stories. If it's a good story, it doesn't matter. And a story about someone failing can be just as interesting as a movie about someone succeeding. Maybe more so, because movies are conflict and people trying, and yeah. It's a weird one. Yeah.
So, remakes...
Sorry.
It's called... Like, we're allowed to... We drift on topic all the time. Like, yeah. So, the idea for this sort of spawned from a discussion we had before, where you had a specific example of a bad film, or at least a film that wasn't well received, or
St. Elmo's Fire.
Taking it, and you had like a different take on it.
So having just said like we shouldn't say what I would have done with the film, I guess. and I haven't even seen St. Elmo's Fire from start to finish. I've seen bits of it. It's a movie made with the 80s Brat Pack actors. So basically all the people are in the Breakfast Club and like those actors around them. And they made lots of big successful movies at the time. And they decided, when they sort of all got a bit older, they sort of were like, instead of being clearly college or older age and playing teenagers... Even then, the studios finally went, well, they just look like college students, don't they? So let's make a movie about them all being in college. And there's something like 8 really famous people in it. Like, Rob Lowe's in it, Judd Nelson, Emilio Estevez, Molly Ringwald, like, all of them. And they all play people who've just graduated from college in, I think, Maine, like, somewhere East Coast-y in America. They've all gone to a vaguely prestigious college, and... It's in America in the 80s, and they all congregate at this bar a lot. Why it's called St. Elmo's Fire, I have no fucking idea. There's a pop single that came out of it called St. Elmo's Fire, which I think is sort of considered to be the most positive legacy of the film, because the movie's just thought to be quite bad. Because it's just... The idea of people who are coming out of college in the 80s and being like, what am I going to do with my life? So I probably go to a massively well-paid job, mate. Like, you know, maybe you should go do that. And then being like, do whatever you like. And so it's not, from what I've seen of it, it's not a very interesting film. It's not a very interesting concept. Everyone has heard of it, especially because of the pop single. And everyone knows it's sort of known as like the Heaven's Gate of the John Hughes era, where it kind of killed those films. And people didn't make any more afterwards. Again, coming back to the failure thing. And then I sort of thought about that. And then a friend, from film school, I've collaborated with some stuff called Anne-Marie. She posted an article about how maybe Hollywood should think about remaking more bad films. And I think the Jump Street movies were referenced in that. And I just thought, like, well, St. Elmo's Fire would be a great candidate for this, because there's nothing... St. Elmo's Fire is almost an idea that would be better if made now with a few tweaks. So now, if you took St. Elmo's Fire and you said, okay, I want to make a movie about 8 people who just graduated from college and are trying to think about what they're going to do with their lives, you could now... The big change to it I would make is I would set it in a state college, or like a sort of lower tier state college or community college. Because apart from the show Community in the US, that narrative isn't really told a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we went to a polytechnic, and that kind of university in British media isn't really seen much, except in The Young Ones. That's really the only thing I can think of that, like, talked about our experience. But just, like, a lot more normal people go there, and a much more diverse cast go there.
Mm.
And coming out of a normal college in this sort of this year, or maybe even a few years ago when the recession was even worse, and then also you put like a more diverse cast in it, so instead of having, you know, 8 posh white people, you know, you have actors like what is it, like Tessa Thompson, Lakeith Stanfield, I guess John Cho is too old, but like, you basically now, because of the push for diversity, there are still far too few, but there are more actors coming up from a more diverse range of backgrounds that you could put in these movies. And you just bring, like, a, you know, you make a movie about working class people coming out of state college, trying to figure out what they're going to do, which is actually a massively tense struggle. Like, it's literally life or death, because you might literally starve.
Yeah.
And that's far more interesting and tense, and also likely to lead to more interesting stories, because it's a more diverse cast of characters.
Mm.
You know, again, if there's 8 people, you could, like, you know, you can have, like, a huge range of gender identities. Like, you can do some, and I don't mean that just because of, like, yay, diversity box ticking. I mean, you will get more interesting stories that way.
Yeah, you have I've said a few times in the past 2 days, actually, yeah. About, like, the advantage of having more diverse voices in the writer's room isn't just about, you know, equal opportunities and fair representation, but it is, you get fresher stories because you have a broader range of perspectives.
Right, I mean, it's like why, I mean, you know, admittedly it is show run by David Simon, who is an old white man, but he made The Wire, which I think it's widely agreed is a movie where he sort of brought in diverse voices, it's about a diverse cast, and it's loved by the people it's about, which is a good indicator that he did not do what most filmmakers of his background do, which is read half an article in The Atlantic and go, yeah, I got this. and so he is showrunning The Deuce, but The Deuce is a movie about 70s New York, but it's about all the people...
TV series.
Yes, sorry, it's TV
series. As is The Wire. You said that was a movie as well.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to... Yeah, no, thank you. It's about all the people who didn't have a voice before. So it's like, yes, it's all... I haven't been depicted in, like, the media of that era, soap, Scorsese films, before. So, you know... Yes, it's about, like, the skeevy sex industry and porn industry, but from the perspective of a female director in the porn industry. You know, it's about the bar culture of the time from the perspective of someone trying to run a gay bar. Like, it's all of those voices where you just... And now you're like, well, now this is fresh. This is interesting because I've not heard this story before. And it's interesting that the person who's fallen into the background the most is James Franco's character, who was clearly brought... Again, clearly the person who got him the financing. He's very much a sort of... straight white male prestige protagonist. But it's just like, well, you've seen James Franco struggle before. Like, is his girlfriend mad at him? Is he going to make rent this week?
Mm.
Like, you know, oh, he's got a mustache. Like, it's just, like, that's it. You know, whereas, and he's clearly gone into the background while all the others have come forward to more. And it's, you just think, yeah, it's not, the thing that makes The Deuce good isn't just looking and going, oh, what a diverse cast and set of creators. It's that it's telling stories that haven't been seen before.
Yeah, and I think, well, that is a quite good, like, a way of looking at remakes of, like, oh, here is an old story that was relevant at the time but has dated, but it's still an interesting idea, and let's have a look at how that idea reflects on modern times. Like, one example that springs to mind, I had an argument with a friend of mine on Twitter, who I will not name, because they announced that they were going to remake Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's a tricky one, because Buffy is still sort of very highly regarded, still. I feel like this friend of mine sort of reacted negatively to it straight away because it was a remake. Because it's like, why remake this thing when this thing already exists and I already love the thing that exists? And like, well, yeah, but it's like, but bring it to new younger people. Like, so I had no issue with it being a remake. But what the conversation was about, and I mean, this is a big topic, which I'm going to try summarise in the next 6 minutes. But it's like the point is that they've cast a person of colour as the new Buffy, and the argument was about like whether or not that was a good decision. And I'm of the opinion that if we like because we're remaking all of these stories, we have to like change races and sexualities and gender identities and do gender swapping and all of these things, because if we're going to keep telling the stories that we've been telling for 50 years, they're always going to be reflective of the times when they were originally created. So like the idea of remaking something and changing something about a character to make it more diverse, I think, yeah, good decision. My friend did not like this decision because and this is quite a valid point, is that they believed that if you remake an existing character with a different race, then it's like, oh, this isn't the definitive version of that character. It's always going to be, oh, this is Black Buffy. It's always going to be like why can't we have an original character rather than have our version of an existing character? And I was like, well, yeah, I take your point, but if you're remaking Buffy anyway, you can't then say, oh, well, Buffy has to remain white because otherwise it's not a good depiction of this character, or our representation is relegated to a reversion, or just an existing character with a new skin painted on it. And I understand that complaint. It's like, yes, we need more original stories, but since we are not making an original story in this context, I think we should be allowed to change it, because for the all the young people who are going to be new to this, Buffy in general, they're not going to go back and watch the old ones in SD. For lots of people, this actress as Buffy is going to be Buffy. And what I brought up was, if you look at Nick Fury, nobody remembers that he was originally a white man. And so I sort of see the point where it's like, oh, now this is just a new, secondary version of the original Buffy. But given enough time, you don't know that maybe original Buffy might be forgotten. Sorry, Sarah Michelle Gellar. You did your best. But for lots of people, it's like, this is going to be original Buffy.
I also think that narrative of, well, it's not really the definitive version of character. I think that a lot of the people who use that as an argument online often have their taste rooted in mainstream comics, and a thing that mainstream comics are very, very guilty of doing is bringing in a like black version of a character. So like Captain America is a Nazi now, so someone else has to step in and be him who is not white. But partially because these like the Marvel and DC are just stupid, and vaguely because I guess they want to generate drama and they want to have the sales of like the original comes back.
Yeah.
Eventually the original always comes back, but it's like, but that won't happen with films. And also, films and TV and other remakes don't have to do that. It's like you're saying, well, people did it badly over here, so therefore it will be bad. It's like, no, you just don't make that stupid mistake.
Yeah.
You let them, if you bring someone in, you let them be that person for as long as the last person was, or longer, until they have a good reason to leave, like they're too old or they another job or whatever. So I think, they could become the definitive version for most people.
And that's the thing, like, there doesn't necessarily need to be a definitive version. You could, like, and if we are going to keep, like, look at, like, we've had three different movie Spider-Mans now, probably more because there's older films that I've forgotten or wasn't alive for, and they've all been young, straight, white men. And it gets, you just, and I don't think any of these particular iterations is necessarily bad, and I don't think it's bad to have straight white men on screen. But you do get to a point where if we keep remaking this character, and we keep making this character a straight white man, it's just like, really? Is this the most creative we can be with this character, for one thing? And also, really, are you saying that a black person, a gay person, a woman, like, can't do this?
Well, it's also like this, I don't know, this sort of weirdness that people have where, like, and it is always straight white men who complain about it. It's like, well, what's the place for us in this world? And they don't want straight white men on screen in these movies. To which my response would be, look at Chris Hemsworth's career. Because Chris Hemsworth, seriously, his entire job now, and I think it's very funny, is to be the straight white male foil in movies. In Ghostbusters, in the new Ghostbusters, he is the dumb straight white man who has to work as their receptionist, and it's very funny. And people often say, like, that was one of the best kind of running gags of the film.
Yeah.
Is that he was so stupid. And in hilarious ways. He's in the new remake, Men in Black. They're remaking Men in Black.
Men in Black?
No, they've already shot it. The agents are played by Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth.
I'd watch that.
Yep, and I would bet money that Chris Hemsworth is the dumb comic foil to Tessa Thompson's hyper-competent character, which I guess is a bit Trinity-y, but on the other hand, like, Chris Hemsworth will be really funny because he's really good at that.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, there are going to be less of us, but we get to be Chris Hemsworth. And all we all fit, like, that seems fine.
Oh, and there's the timer. I do want to say, like, yeah, that's fine as well, but I know there's going to be, like, some people like to complain, look, it's an attack on straight white men because we always have to be the underdogs. Like, no, there's still going to be stories about competent straight white men. But it's also, like, I think the reason why straight white men sort of react so viscerally to this sort of thing is because they are not used to being a subcategory of human. They are used to being human neutral, and everyone else is a subcategory. And it's like, and as Hannah Gadsby quite rightly points out in Nanette, it's like, no, you made the rules, read them.
Yeah, I think a movie that is fantastic is an adaptation called The Hate U Give, which is in cinemas. There is one prominent good white character in the movie, which is the boyfriend of the teenage female black protagonist, who is literally played by the guy who plays Archie in Riverdale. It's almost meta casting, where it's like she has like a jock white boyfriend, so he's Archie, and he's honestly, like, obviously there are people who are going to look at that movie and be like, oh, it's anti-white because there's only this one character, and I honestly think that movie. The people who get annoyed by that don't behave like the good white people in those movies.
No.
And that's what really bothers them. Is that it's not that they don't see white people, it's that they don't see themselves, but they're dicks. And, like, I do think it's fine to have white people on screen. I don't think we need... we do need assholes on screen, but they should be framed as such.
Yeah.
And that's... Yeah.
Okay, I don't know how we ended up here. Remakes are... I guess our point is remakes are not inherently bad. They are not inherently good. There's lots of different reasons why you might make a remake. And yay.
Yeah, try your best. I'm sure it'll be good.
Yeah. What a waste of time.
What a Waste of Time featured the voices of me, Jim Woodall, and Callum Smith. Music by Anthony Bullinger.